Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. Joining me very shortly is Matt Stoller. Matt is the author of Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy. He also writes a phenomenal Substack, mattstoller.substack.com, called Big, where he talks about monopoly power and the changing attitude towards it. It's a fantastic read. The book is filled with great stories. I'm sure you will really enjoy reading that, as you will, I feel certain, enjoy the conversation that I'm about to have with Matt himself. So without any further ado, here's Matt Stoller. Matt, welcome to the podcast. I'm extremely grateful you've taken the time to chat with me today. I've been looking forward to this for quite some time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, the subject of monopolies is the topic du jour. But before we get into that and your stellar work on the subject, I'd love you to give people a sense of your background, because it's so important when we come into the meat of the discussion and the work you've been doing. So tell us how you kind of came to be involved in this particular area of the economy.
Sure. Yeah. So I've been doing politics and policy for about 20 years, and I got interested in market power largely because I was working in Congress during the financial crisis when we completely fixed too big to fail banks. It's all taken care of. You're welcome. So I got really interested in banks and corporations as part of a political system and what role they play. And coming out of the financial crisis in 2011 and 12, you start to see, well, wait, too big to fail doesn't just apply to the banks. We have a lot of other big institutions, from search engines to airlines to lots of stuff in the medical system. And as it turns out, the philosophies that led to the growth of dominant financial institutions and mass foreclosure waves also led to the growth of dominant market power and all these other segments of the economy. So I got really interested in that. I can go into more about why that is, but I started to write about what we have in this country, and I think globally, although it's worse in the US, which is a monopoly crisis. And it's a political story. It's not just a business story. So I wrote a book called Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy, which I tried to write in a fun, accessible way, because I believe that these stories are important for everyone to know. And I write a Substack called Big, in which I write about market power and the different weird things that happen and enforcement agencies and, the economy, but looking at it through like these specific industries and examples. And then I'm also at a think tank called the American Economic Liberties Project, where we focus on the public policy problem of private power. So that's who I am. That's how I got interested in this. Yeah.
It's such an interesting area, and we'll dig into it and see. But I want to go back to the post-financial crisis and get a sense of the attempts during that time to make policy, because obviously everybody was running around with their hair on fire, and this wasn't a time for thoughtful deliberation. This was a time for action. So take us inside that process, and whether there was a sense of satisfaction from the people who were brought together to try and fix things, or there was a sense of frustration that they were forced to take actions in the moment to staunch the blood flow rather than make meaningful changes to the system, which is clearly what was needed.
It's a really good question. So just to give you a sense of my politics and where I sat, right? So I started working in Congress in early 2009. So it was like the financial crisis was kind of in full throes, but the bailouts had been passed, although there were still like some monies that had to be unlocked. I was a staffer for a Democrat who got put on the House Financial Services Committee. And while he's a Democrat and I was an AM Democrat, I was also sort of part of the network of people who opposed what Tim Geithner was doing.
Right.
So there were different factions within the Democratic Party. Ultimately, the Tim Geithner, Ben Bernanke, Barack Obama faction won and determined the shape of the recovery from the financial crisis, determined the shape of the foreclosure crisis. But that, like, we were opposed to that from within the Democratic Party, not from the right. So what was happening, I think, when I first got there was just like total confusion. People didn't know what was happening. I mean, normally, at the very least, like lobbyists at least know how to steal money.
Right.
Because it was just like I want to steal money from there, but that market just blew up, right? Like that, not to be like really cynical, because I'm not actually, I'm an optimist, but that, you know, that was the gist of it, right? And when you start working in Congress, like the first thing that happens is, you know, a lot of people who go to work in Congress don't know anything about the areas they were going to go work in. And I didn't know anything about banking, which, as it turns out, was really useful, because nobody really seemed to know anything about banking. I just wasn't arrogant enough to think that I did, just because I didn't have like much background in it. So you get there and you go to like banking university, which is really just like a week of, I forget, I don't think that's what it's called, but it's like the American Bankers Association, which is the main lobbying group for the big banks and also for small banks, but mostly the big ones. They basically just put on a week-long seminar for any congressional staff, or just teaching you this is how banking works. And they just are like, here are the basics of banking. Here's credit analysis. Here are the different kinds of banks. Here are how the rules work. And it's like, it's supposed to just be like neutral, but of course it's not. They're teaching you in a specific way, but there's all of these kind of soft power elements that exist within Congress. But at the time, right, in early 2009, there was this change over the course of several years where people came in. The Democrats had won in 2006 and they had won in 2008. And so there were all of these new members who were mad, and because they were reflecting their constituents. They were angry that they thought that the Bush administration had mishandled the banks. They also thought that the banks were too big and powerful, and this was just a big mess. And so they were like, we need to do something about the banks. We need to do something about the bonuses. Like, let's get to work. And over the course of several years, the kind of arguments from Bernanke, from Geithner, and really it was Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan working through the Federal Reserve, which then worked through the Treasury, which then got inserted through Congress through like Barney Frank and Rahm Emanuel.
Right.
Those arguments, like, they essentially ground us down. And so in early 2009, we would have these staff or congressional like meetings where bankers would come in and we would like be like really angry with them and be like, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? Like they were on the hot seat. And like towards the end, late 2010, after everyone had been kind of beaten down, if people were still mad, it was just like, oh, that's adorable. Like, that's not, you know, some people trying to get jobs, but it was really just like, there was this joke starting kind of in 2010, where like a friend of mine kept saying, you know, you'd bring up a problem. And in 2009, when you were like, there's this problem, we have to solve it, people would be like, all right, what do we do? How do we, because there was this sense of hope the legislative process could work. By 2010, everyone knew, all right, they know what they want to do. They're going to do it. They don't care. They're not going to take any other feedback. So when you would say, here's this huge, massive problem with derivatives or whatever it is, you know, he would just say, yeah, someone should do something about that.
Right.
And then we'd all laugh, like, because it was just like, it was so corrosive and cynical. And everybody knew that Dodd-Frank was nothing. I'm like kind of amused by Silicon Valley Bank, because they're like, oh my gosh, Dodd-Frank with all of this busy work didn't seem to do anything. I was like, yeah, we knew that. Everybody knew it. So it was a very disillusioning experience, because the other thing that was happening, like the real policy choices were the bailouts, reappointing Ben Bernanke, and then allowing the foreclosure crisis to happen, right? And that's what essentially was the whole Obama administration. And it was really uncomfortable for Democrats to admit it, to even know what was happening. And I was like one of the only people on the Democratic side being like, guys, we're the bad guys. Like, we did the bad things, right? And so that was hard for people to hear. So they just sort of didn't hear it. And so all of this political chaos happened. So the person who told me about what was going on during the crisis was this old economist named Jane DeRista. In 2009, nobody knew what was going on. The Fed didn't know, Treasury didn't know, bank lobbyists, none of them knew what was happening. But Jane would be, I'd like met her, because I used to be a blogger before I went into Congress. And so I respected people who, you know, scream into the void angrily. Yeah. You can tell who's crazy and who's not. I kind of have more respect for that than most people. And so I met all of the losers of the financial policy fights over the last 30 years. I met a bunch of them and they lost, but the policies they wanted were good and they lost the fight. And so we had a bad policy. So Jane would tell me, yeah, this market is going to blow up, or that one's going to blow up, or here's the solution to this one. And then it would all happen that way. And I'd be like, how did you know all of this? And she was like, oh, well, I worked for this congressman in the 60s named Wright Patman, 60s and 70s, who was the chair of the banking committee. And then I worked after he got sort of dethroned and then he died. I worked for other people in the 80s. And she's like, I saw all of the guardrails being taken off of finance.
Right.
And when you know that, okay, that guardrail gets taken off, this is where you're going to fall out. That's where you're going to fall out. So she told me these amazing stories about some of the fights that had happened in the 1970s that would like kind of led to where we are today. Then a couple of years later, she tried to get me interested in her old boss, this congressman named Wright Patman. And I was like, yeah, whatever. I'm just interested in banks. Then a couple of years later, I was reading a book about monopolies and antitrust. And there was this law that was called the Robinson-Patman Act that was originally passed in 1936 to constrain chain stores. At the time, it was the A&P supermarket, but today it would be like Walmart or Amazon. And when we stopped enforcing Robinson-Patman, that's when Walmart exploded in the 70s. And the failure to enforce Robinson-Patman, it's still on the books, we just don't enforce it, is one of the reasons like we have these dominant middlemen in our economy. So I was like, wait a second, Robinson-Patman, that's like Patman, that guy Wright Patman, who was the chair of the banking committee in the 60s and 70s, who got then overthrown by the Bill Clinton generation in 1975 that Jane kept trying to tell me about.
Yeah.
There's a story here. That was the basis for like my research and ultimately a book I wrote, which was about this lost history, this kind of Anglo-American tradition that goes back to the 1600s about the political threat of concentrated finance and monopoly, and what that means in the context of having a society where we can or cannot govern ourselves. So that's kind of eventually how I got to the philosophical underpinnings of essentially what are populist politics, which are fear and suspicion of concentrated power.
Well, we'll get into the monopoly side of it in a second. I just want to ask you one more question about that particular time, because you know, for someone in finance who is proudly skeptical, but it's something I learned over a long time. I didn't start that way. I realized that it made far more sense to be skeptical early once you've been in banking for long enough than rather to wait to have it forced upon you. But there was a certain sense that Obama had an opportunity, given the mandate the people had given him, to stand there on TV and say, hey, this is going to be hard. This is going to be a tough few years, but we need to make meaningful changes here. And people are going to lose their jobs and companies are going to go bust. This is capitalism. We have to make sure that we stick to this. And all the principles that we've espoused both here and abroad for years and years and years, stick with me. And I've long had this maybe misguided belief that had he done that, he would have had buy-in from the voting public to take some pain and to make some real changes that would actually affect things going forward. Was there a sense of that from within the process? Or, as I say, were you just so wrapped up in we need to do something that it was not really any kind of opportunity to be philosophical or principled?
No, very much there was a sense of that. Look, I can only speak for myself, and I'm not super partisan, and I don't know. You're not going to find a lot of people who...
It's amazing how that's become weird, right? It's a shame.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. So I'll just tell you a quick story. So in 2010, I went to Sweden on a vacation. And one of the cool things about being a congressional staffer is you can talk. Like if you email someone, there's a pretty good chance they're going to be like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll talk to you. And the guy I worked for was on the Financial Services Committee. So I emailed the guy in Sweden who had handled their banking crisis in the early 1990s, which was very similar to the banking crisis, where the global financial crisis was much smaller. And I met with him and I was just like, what were you thinking? Because in Sweden, they nationalized their banks and then reprivatized. They basically broke up their banks, right? Essentially. And he said to me, you know, well, this is what we did. We thought it was kind of crazy what you were doing in 2008. And I was like, where'd you get your idea of what you did? He said, oh, well, we just copied what the US did in the 1930s, right? So there had been this debate in 2010, like this philosophical debate, not grand philosophy, but banking law, where Obama kind of had to choose between like the Swedish solution, which was take the banks, break them up, recapitalize them, wipe out the bondholders, whatever it was, do the hard choices of reorienting like our power structure, or the like soft option, which was just to bail out the banks and allow for the existing like people who were running things to keep running them, right? And Paul Krugman and a bunch of others were like advocating for the Swedish solution, right? And this is why I wrote a history, by the way. This whole tradition was dormant. People did not know it. So Obama gets asked. He didn't get questioned a lot on what he was doing, on the details of what he was doing. Occasionally he would get a question and he would answer it in these really interesting ways. But at a certain point he was asked, why didn't you do the Swedish solution? And he said, well, America has a lot of banks. Sweden doesn't have very many banks, so it's like not as hard to do it in Sweden, but it's hard to do here because we just got a ton of banks. And besides, Sweden is Sweden, this is America, and we have different traditions in this country. And it was incredible because he did not know that Sweden got their concept from the US. And this was because of a book that was written by Jonathan Alter called, I forget exactly, it was like On the First 100 Days of FDR. That was basically a fake history of the New Deal. Actually written, the sourcing that Alter used was FDR's enemies, like who had a particular reason to misconstrue the history. It doesn't really matter what you think of FDR. It was just like a bad history that didn't explain what happened in the banking system at the time. And so when Obama was thinking about this, and when most Democrats were thinking about this, including me, I didn't know this history either, you're kind of bounded by what you think was possible in the past. It opens options or closes them. And since he didn't know that there had been this populist tradition, that there had been all of these choices, there had been all of these battles, he didn't think it was possible. And because his critics, like people like me or his opponents, didn't know that that was the alternative, like that had been in our history, we were just kind of mad. We were like, you should treat people differently. But we didn't have a particularly grounded philosophy of an alternative perspective, an other way to do things. And so that, I think, failure to know that history, like nobody knew who Wright Papen was. Today, more people do because of some of the bringing back some of these old traditions. But we're in a very different moment. You think about how people are deploying AI today, right? There was a hearing in the Senate today, but there's lots of hearings all over the world. People are talking about the power of that technology as a political construct. We're kind of over the idea that, let's let private business do whatever they want. We recognize that market structure is as important in terms of determining what kind of technology we build as anything else. And these are political choices. So the old way of seeing things, what Obama saw, which is just like, we have this history, the way that America succeeds is by putting experts in charge of things. Who knows more about banks than the biggest bankers? So let's put them in charge. This idea that we further consolidate power in response to a crisis caused by consolidation of power, that was very much what they were thinking. And they were thinking about it not for bad faith. It wasn't corruption. It was because there's always corruption in every system. That's not what drove this.
Sure.
Their philosophy was, we need to trust the experts. That's why they did Obamacare, which consolidated power, but put a regulatory overlay on top of it. It's why they did Dodd-Frank, which did the same thing. It's why they did in a bunch of different areas, they consolidated power because they thought, well, this is the way that you need to actually organize your society. You can see it today. One of the things that these guys are arguing for is fewer banks. They're like, America has too many banks, because they just think I don't want anyone to be able to have a bank. We need the experts to be able to control credit allocation, because the experts know what they're doing, right? And that is the fundamental philosophy that Obama and Geithner and Bernanke and a lot of people really believe in. And this is broadly held. This is not just a couple of elites here or there. People get scared when you go against what the experts think, broadly speaking. So this has always been the challenge of populism. It's not that populists reject expertise. It's just it's saying that experts should serve the public as opposed to experts should make political decisions.
Yeah.
These are subtle gradations, but that was the philosophical fight that we didn't know we were having, but we were having.
It's so interesting because this idea of the expert is fundamental to us. And as life gets more complicated, and there's very few areas of life that are more complicated than banking. I mean, it plays into the hands of bankers superbly, because do we take the time for us to explain to you what's going on, but it's really, really complicated? Or do you want to give us the means by which to fix this, because we understand it better than you ever will, and we can fix this, right? And that happens everywhere. And unfortunately, as we've gone through COVID, not just in the US, but everywhere, this idea of the expert has become somewhat problematic, because you could find at every stage of that process an expert that would give you diametrically opposed reasonings on the data and what it was telling you, and COVID was this and COVID was that, and each one of them was an expert. And we're surrounded by experts and people in suits and behind podiums with microphones that tell us how it is. And we've delegated our responsibility to the guy in the suit. And when you kind of bring that to monopoly, which is where I want to focus now, this idea of monopoly, it's a word that I think everybody knows, but so few people associate, really, unless you sit and think about it, with anything bad. They think of the board game. It's a word we're familiar with. So explain to us why monopolies are such a problem for the US economy and why monopolies are so fundamentally anti-capitalist.
Yeah, people associate monopoly with the board game and making their 8-year-old sibling cry.
That's right. Exactly right.
There's actually a board game called Anti-Monopoly, but the problem with it is that it never ends, because whenever anybody gets like some power, they just break it up. Kind of boring. It's really interesting. There's a lot of new scholarship on Monopoly, and there are different anti-monopoly traditions, and there are different ways of thinking about this. There's the land monopoly, which doesn't necessarily mean having only one entity control all the land, but could mean, you know, consolidation of land and resources. There are industrial monopolies. There are the control of bottleneck resources by nations,
yep,
which is a kind of like commercial oriented anti-monopoly tradition, which you sort of see with a lot of fears of China or, you know, the US and semiconductors. Like, there are all of these really interesting different ways to talk about monopoly. And there's no one agreement on what monopoly means. There are different definitions. I would say that the tradition I'm in is a kind of Brandeisian tradition, which comes from Louis Brandeis, who was a Supreme Court justice from 1916 to the 1930s and was an antitrust and labor lawyer. Generally speaking, when I look at what is the problem of monopoly, I would look at it and say, when you have unified control of a recognized branch of trade or service, and that doesn't have to be one firm, it can be three firms, but they kind of tacitly collude or whatever it is. And the problem with monopoly, there's a number of problems. There's like the economic problems. Like, there's the problems you can just tell, like, right off the bat, like, okay, higher prices is just one, right? If you have one supplier of something and you need that thing, whatever it is, you're going to be a price taker. There's also that monopolist sets the terms in the industry. If you work in that industry, you only got a, let's say, three companies, which is an oligopoly, but is essentially what I call a monopoly, because it's oligopoly is an annoying word to say. But it's like, now you only have three options to work for. And they kind of usually tacitly collude. And so they set labor conditions. And then they set the terms of trade for anybody that wants to be in or adjacent to that industry. They also decide how innovation happens in that industry. So you go back to like Microsoft in the late 90s, one of the reasons there was a lawsuit against them is because they sat all the venture capitalists in a room in the mid 90s. And they said, all right, here are the areas of this thing called the internet that we want. And here are the things that you are allowed to invest in. And so those venture capitalists were scared of Microsoft, but they went to Al Gore and they said, we've got a problem here. And then they brought an antitrust suit against Microsoft. And because Microsoft lost that suit, they weren't broken up, but they did lose it. And there were then lawyers sitting with all the engineers. When the engineers or when some business executive was like, let's crush this small search engine called Google, the lawyers would say, you can't do that. Remember, we lost that big suit. And so how the internet developed in the early 2000s was a function of the fact that Microsoft couldn't control the deployment of technology. So the biggest problem, though, with monopoly is political. It's not that monopolies lobby, big companies lobby. That's not the issue. It's that when you are a stakeholder in a monopolized industry, you are working for a private government. And you're not in a democratic society. You are living in a little autocracy that's in your particular area of the world.
Right.
People don't think about work that way. And I'm not talking about like if you're just a worker. I'm saying like you go to wealthy venture capitalists or bankers or whoever else, and they are afraid of retaliation, right? I've talked to people who are very wealthy. I've talked to people who are very poor. I've talked to people who are in government contracting. I've talked to people who are in the business of cheerleading, right? Cheerleading camps. They all are afraid of being retaliated against because of the market power of a central sort of mob boss. Yeah. They're not living in a free society. And when you have enough industries that operate that way, people get used to not living in a free society, and they look at democratic institutions. They look at elections. They look at like legislative bodies as kind of ornamental, but not real. So the practice of democracy atrophies, not the symbols of it, but the real practice of it, yeah, which is be a citizen, to make political claims, to claim your space, to take responsibility, to have some power and responsibility for your community. All of these things atrophy over time because the people in charge are sort of these distant masters who live in another city and kind of control. Sometimes they're not necessarily malevolent. They just don't live near you.
Yep.
And you have no power over them. So that's what's happened, I think, is people have gotten used to living in these kind of like, they look democratic, but they're like, they're kind of corporatist. people talk about the liberal international order or save democracy or whatever, but like most people kind of don't really live in a super free society. They live definitely more free than like, say, China. You definitely have political rights in some ways, but like you got a boss and that boss is really powerful, right? And so that's the biggest problem with monopoly.
So do you get a sense that what we're going through now, a part of that in terms of the kind of just the agitation on a general level in society on a day-to-day basis, is part of that people, maybe not even knowingly, but starting to understand the position that they're in with this regard, is that I'm not free. I don't have the ability to choose. I don't have the ability to get out from under something. And I'm not going to, you know, use the jackboot word, but I'm under something here. And I can't figure out what it is, but it's not right.
Right. I think that's right. So like there was this doctor during the initial stages of COVID who was working for like this shitty private equity owned monopoly doctor's practice where they sign all their doctors to non-compete agreements. And I think he was complaining that they weren't getting certain equipment they needed to treat COVID. And then he got like fired and basically blackballed from the industry. And everyone else, these doctors who are, you know, afraid of getting COVID because we didn't know what it was at first.
Right, right.
Felt like they couldn't speak up. And that's really dangerous, right? And that's the world they're living in. That's the actual world they're living in. You might have the First Amendment for free speech or whatever, but like they're controlled by Envision. Now, one of the reasons, and I'm going to speculate politically, so I could be wrong about this, but I think one of the things that happened when Donald Trump started to emerge on the political scene, Donald Trump's philosophy was not, we have these like different parts of government and the government has this relationship with the private sector and all of these traditional political norms. Donald Trump's view of the world is, I'm a boss and there are other bosses. And so when Carrier, there was this moment in 2016 when Carrier, which makes like heating and cooling units, laid a bunch of people off. It went viral and was this dipshit consultant being really condescending and all the workers getting really upset about it, obviously, because their factory is being moved to Mexico. And like Obama had made fun of the idea that we could stop offshoring and said, that's just the way of the world. That's globalization, right? And Donald Trump was like, I'm going to call the boss a Carrier and we're going to work out a deal. And it was like, people thought it's not the job of the president to cut private business deals. That's like inappropriate. And I think if you're just like a liberal Democrat who is working in a functional society, which I am a liberal Democrat, you know, if we had a functional society in general, I think it's probably not a good idea for the president to be doing that. But the way Donald Trump saw it is he's just like, the president is one boss and there are lots of other bosses and I'm going to be a boss that's going to work. You're my people and I'm going to protect my people versus all these other bosses. Those people aren't my people, so screw them. But that's like the way that he thought about the world, and that's the way his supporters saw him. Yeah. And it like made sense to people because in a monopolized economy, that is what it feels like. And you want a powerful boss on your side to fight their boss. And then you don't have to distinguish between like a Supreme Court justice or the leader of a Fortune 500
right,
company.
Just somebody.
They're all bosses, right? It shouldn't be that way in a free society, but that is the way it is right now. And I think that's one of the vibes that people got from Donald Trump. It's like, he's a boss and the political leaders, we want a boss in there as a political leader.
So how much of the problem is government's just gotten too big? Because there's so much red tape, there's so much new policy, and it just makes it that much easier for big companies to be able to deal with this and navigate it over small companies and ends up just consolidating power. How much of the problem is big government?
So I think the problem isn't that government is big. The problem is government is weak, right?
Okay.
So the worst thing to have is a big, weak government. And I think that's what we have right now. The other thing is that like the difference between government and like a private company is pretty blurry. So the traditional way that we organized, I think, our political economy in this country is we tried to move as much power to localities and states as possible, because you know what's going on in your community better than anyone else. And so you should have more control over what's going on in your community. But some things need to be regulated at a federal level. Like you're going to have railroads, you're going to have like airlines, you're just like a lot of stuff, search engine, whatever. It's like, yeah, it doesn't make sense to have like a local ordinance for, I don't know, a railroad, right? Like a little bit here and there. But like one of the things that happened, I think, starting in the 80s was this tremendous centralization of power. And that happened both with the government growing, but also with, it was sort of explicit that we're going to relax antitrust enforcement. Antitrust is the key body of law that orients the government's thinking around corporate power. But it's like what we did in the early 80s, and this was the Reagan administration, is they said, we are no longer going to enforce antitrust law anymore. We're going to allow consolidation across the board. And what that kind of naturally does, like when you have a, say, a bunch of companies that all become one company, and then that company has dominant market power, the CEO of that company typically stops thinking about their competitors because they don't have any. And they start thinking about, how do they maintain their monopoly? How do they get better tax concessions? How do they maybe erect political barriers to entry? Like, you transform the business executive from a somebody that thinks about the operations of a factory to somebody that thinks about like lobbying government. And that's a really explicit change that happened in the 70s and 80s in the corporate culture. I mean, I'm sure you might have seen this, but like in the 80s, there were big fights between like the industrial CEO and the financial CEO.
For sure.
So part of it is like the financial CEO won that fight. And, you know, nobody loves government regulation more than some private equity guy that's found some way to jack up prices in this particular area because of a weird, stupid rule. And then they're going to fight like hell to keep that weird, stupid rule in place. So the consolidation of market power and the creation of this giant, flaccid, weak state are conjoined, right? What we need is to break consolidated power like across the board. And I think if you did that by going after big business and breaking them up, breaking their power and banning certain unlawful practices, you would also see really radical change in government as well, which would be really helpful. But like, we have this really bad dynamic because when people, and I think this is particularly true on the right, there is fear on the left of this, but this is more of a right-wing problem. When you're like, okay, we need to decentralize power, the way to do that is to have the government come in and break up these companies, which you don't need a lot of government to do that. You just need like a few lawyers to force this company to split up. But like the right wing, who most conservatives really do want monopolies broken up, but they're really afraid of the government getting the power to do that. They're like, okay, that just means you're going to be growing the government, right? And you're not actually growing the government. You're just like saying the government has the authority to break up these companies. Or you can even say like private individuals do. You can just do private rights of action. But there's all of these legacy fears of giant government power or out of control trial lawyers or whatever. And now that there's a recognition that we have a monopoly problem, and I think everybody kind of concedes that, like everybody sees like Google's really powerful and that's kind of a problem. Well, then you need to like have some entity that isn't that corporation do something about it. And you need to empower that entity, whether it's a plaintiff's lawyer, whether it's a government enforcer or a state enforcer or something like that. Somebody, if you want a free society, somebody's going to have to take on that problem. And that's where I think the stage we're in, where like there isn't a consensus about who we trust to have that power.
So interesting. That pendulum swings back and forward from one extreme to the other. And you've mentioned Google there. We've talked about tech a couple of times. So let's move on to tech, because I know you've got some very strong opinions on the tech franchises and how strong and how powerful they've become. We've just seen in Europe, we've seen the UK regulator block the Microsoft deal, right, and the EU regulator let it go. Right. So it's interesting. Does that mean we're at a point where we're starting to see the pendulum go back the other way potentially? Or is that just a one-off idiosyncratic UK thing? So let's move on to tech in general.
Well, it's not a one-off. I mean, this is a long time coming, and it's not just the UK. The Competition and Markets Authority in the UK is the best antitrust enforcer in the world. The Australians are very good as well. And the US enforcers are being very aggressive, but our judicial system, it makes that difficult in terms of policy outcomes. However, the Federal Trade Commission and Antitrust Division here, we have two main enforcers. There's also state level enforcers, have really dramatically ramped up enforcement. What you see is a record number of mergers have been blocked. So this year, the last data I saw was that there's been a decline of 76% of mergers since last year. So that's a huge drop. Not all of that is antitrust related. A lot of that is just that it's more difficult to finance acquisitions. But you talk to deal makers and they'll say, look, it's more expensive with an acquisition, but also if we think we're going to have to fight for it through regulators, like it's not worth it. So the two of them kind of go together. So it's been a dramatic change in the US. Like the Federal Trade Commission is challenging the Microsoft Activision deal, as well as the CMA in England. The CMA has a lot more power than the FTC here, because this, what the CMA says goes. There's an appeals process, but it's hard to overturn one of their decisions. So it's a sea change. And that change started probably, like, I would say, you could trace it back to the financial crisis, but the policy debates really started in 2016, maybe, when Trump started talking about AT&T Time Warner. And Trump brought the first case against Google in 2020. It was a federal case, a monopolization case. And then the Biden administration appointed two very aggressive antitrust enforcers to kind of continue and amplify that, which was Jonathan Cantor at the Antitrust Division and Lina Khan at the Federal Trade Commission. Both of them have tried to look for ways to be very aggressive with dormant authorities. So Trump brought one Google case. Jonathan Cantor under Biden has brought a different case. So continued the Trump case and then brought another different case that has to do with a different part of Google. And I think they brought a case on app stores against Google. And then I believe the FTC is probably going to bring cases against Amazon. And the DOJ is looking at cases against Apple. Oh, then the FTC also under Trump brought a case against Facebook. And they've actually brought multiple cases against Facebook. They lost one of them, which was a merger case. But like, so you're seeing significant action to address dominant market power among big tech firms all over the world. And where we are is we're running into this kind of like what I said before, where there's just a distrust in the judiciary about, do we really trust the government to know what's best about these firms and in these markets, right? And a lot of the judges don't buy that we have a monopoly problem. Some of them do, some of them don't. Like in Europe, so the CMA is into this, but in Europe, the bureaucrats in the EU are very uncomfortable doing anything meaningful. That's why they let the Microsoft Activision deal go through. Like, for example, the Microsoft Activision deal is a good example because it's a huge merger. The allegation from both the FTC in the US, the CMA in the UK, and the DG Comp in the EU is, by the way, if I use all their formal names, people will find that impressive. And or even though I'm wearing a t-shirt, they'll trust me.
They can't see that. Don't worry. It's impressive all the way.
Okay, good, good, good. I'm wearing a suit is what I mean. It's a very fancy. So they all agreed that what Microsoft is trying to do with this acquisition is they're trying to establish a monopoly in what's called cloud gaming, which is you'd basically be able to use any device to play any game off of, and you don't have to have the local computing power because it comes off the cloud. It's not a very important part of the gaming world, but it will be in 10 years. It'll be everything, or it'll be very important. Not consoles, but cloud gaming.
Right.
And Microsoft had about 60, 70% share in that. They don't have that share in consoles. So a lot of people thought this is about like the Xbox, but it's not. So all three agreed Microsoft, by buying Activision, is going to make it harder for rivals to get into cloud gaming. The difference is that the EU decided, well, if Microsoft makes some promises that they'll let people into cloud gaming, then we're all good because we want to let big companies do what they want to do because we think that's efficient. Again, let's listen to experts. And who's more of an expert about like video gaming than Microsoft and Activision?
Right.
Versus the FTC and the CMA, who are like, well, we all agree that this is not a good thing that they want to do. They have the incentive to monopolize. So let's just not let them combine. Because they're just like, well, we don't trust them. They'll be able to do whatever they need to do that would be efficient by contract if they want to. They don't need to merge. So that's where the CMA is. He has to bring the case. And you know, the response of Microsoft was like fascinating because you got Brad Smith, who's the president of Microsoft, and he actually said this about the UK. He said, you know, this is just our darkest day. We've been in the UK for 40 years, and this is the darkest day that we've ever experienced there. We spend so much money in the UK helping nonprofits and schools and all these. And you know what? We defend the UK from cyber attacks. And for them to do this to us, it's just really like sad. And he basically just threatened, well, like, yeah, you guys want cyber defense? Like, yeah, you better not screw with us. And it was just like, that level of entitlement, because they block a video game merger, that level of entitlement really shows that, yeah, and it's not just Microsoft, lots of companies do sure. this and think about it that way. They really believe that l'état c'est moi, you know, like Microsoft should run things. And it's like, that's a real problem if you think that we should be self-governing. These are not democratic institutions, nor should they be. Like, a corporation shouldn't be a democracy. But like, why is Microsoft kind of contesting the sovereign power of the UK? Like, that's a problem, right? So I thought that that was like an interesting sort of moment when like we really saw like the mask come off and like somebody came out and said, yeah, we really do believe that we should run the world and you can do your little free speech thing. Right.
So what does this mean for big tech, Matt? Because big tech has become almost a monopoly in the stock market. You know, if you look at the returns of the stock market, it's essentially, as you say, an oligopoly, but that is hard to say. So let's call it a monopoly. Big tech is much more, I think, in people's minds now as like this kind of, it's almost like the Borg. Big tech has this idea that it's something, and people don't really differentiate anymore between Google and Facebook and Netflix, and it's just big tech now. What does that portend for the future there? Does that make it easier for government to make enforcements against big tech rather than a company? Or does that give them far too much power and make them even more dangerous, particularly as we see AI increasing in sophistication almost by the day?
So you mean just like calling them big tech, does that help or hurt? Is that the question?
Yeah. I think everyone has this sense of big tech. And my feeling is that the phrase big tech has become more ominous, you know. Ooh. It's become more big brotherish, if you like. It's become more like there's something there that's above us all, that's
big oil, big tobacco.
Yeah, like, I mean, this big thing, I mean, I always make jokes about this, you know, about people being in league with big X or Y. But I think big tech is so much in the lexicon now that people don't really differentiate. Does that make it easier or harder for it to be governed?
I think it makes it easier. I mean... So there was a really good report that came out from the antitrust subcommittee in, I believe it was like 2021, maybe, or 2020, where they did a year and a half investigation, millions of documents, and interviewed hundreds of competitors and said, like, let's look at Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple, big tech, right? We'll leave Microsoft out because they're the nice ones. They already had their antitrust moment, right? And let's look at how these businesses work. Right. I think a lot of the problem, by the way, a lot of the political problem is not that politicians don't want to do anything. I think a lot of the political problem is that politicians and governments have not understood how these markets work. So you don't understand how the market works. You can't really do anything about it, even if you want to. But that's changed a lot. I think there's been a tremendous increase in sophistication on the part of politicians. They understand these are often advertising businesses or consumer product businesses. They're different businesses, right? But like in that report, which was a critical moment for like learning, but the public learned, the politicians learned, essentially what the argument was is that these four companies, what they share is that they are core infrastructure for society. And they use their infrastructure power to be gatekeepers. They fortify their own market power, and then they leverage their market power from one area into another, right? So it's a good example right now. Google has 90% of the search market. So in 2007, you had this thing called the iPhone that came out, and Google had a monopoly in desktop search. It was only like 3 or 4 years old at that time. But they're like, oh shit, there's this new, totally new platform that has like different attributes, right? You can walk around with it. Like it has, there's potential entrants in different forms of search. And so they did a bunch of things to leverage their power from desktop search to mobile search. And that was a kind of inflection point. And one of the things they did is they bought Android, they signed contract, they did a bunch of different things, but then they also used that to leverage into email. So Gmail, at this point, they have 15 products with more than 500 million users. And part of that is YouTube and just leveraging mergers.
Right.
And now they're doing it right now with AI, or they're hoping to. Google's main AI product is called Bard. They're hoping to build on top of their existing search monopoly. They're hoping to leverage into this other infrastructure model, which is much more built in. Even though Google is very built into the way we do things, this would be even more built in. And that's something Apple does. It's something Amazon does. It's something that Meta does. It's something that Microsoft does. And I think like when you look at it and you say, okay, they all have different businesses, but they have some commonalities. I think that really helps because law works through metaphor. And if you're like, well, this thing that Google is doing is kind of like this other thing that Apple is doing, or kind of like this other thing that Ticketmaster is doing, or whatever it is, judges understand. It helps the public understand. It helps people understand what's going on. So like I'm talking about this weird, complicated pharmaceutical merger that the FTC is trying to block, which is between Amgen and this company called Horizon Yep. Therapeutics. And like trying to explain what is going on with this merger, essentially what you have to say is you have to do it by analogy. You have to say, well, what Amgen is trying to do is they're trying to buy the shelf space by like paying off the entity with the shelf space and then say, don't stock my rivals on there. And it's like, they're not actual shelf space. That's not action. Like it's a metaphor for what they're doing, but that's how law works. You have to explain via analogy, especially an area of law like antitrust, where you have certain practices that are unlawful. But those practices, even though it's the same practice, it looks different than when it's like an oil pipeline versus a distribution of like a cheerleading outfit. But the practice could be the same.
Do you think there's a change as the generations change? You know, the attitude towards data, which is obviously one of the most significant places of threat when it comes to monopoly and consolidation. You know, millennials, Gen Z, there's very little urge to have any privacy for them. They're very happy to give away data, to have presence online. That seems to be much more of a kind of boomer Gen X worry about this idea about privacy. Do you think that this lower requirement for privacy is a tailwind for monopolies? Do you think that that maybe, you know, stops some of the arguments, stops some of the protests in terms of what might get some of these deals banned in the big tech world?
You know, I think that people are not averse to privacy. They want privacy. They just don't think they have it, right? So it's, they're like, it's too late. They're tracking everything I do already. And you can see this whole thing, right? 10 years ago, people were mad about it. Now they're just resigned to it. That doesn't mean that they like it. They just, like a lot of things, people will just be like, well, it's not worth being annoyed at this. Just shit happens, right? It's raining today. Like, why am I going to be annoyed at the weather? Like, that's just what happens, right? That's kind of the way I think people have internalized this. I'd say in terms of the generational question, I think there's a lot more skepticism of corporate power among younger people, just because if you're older, you've like experienced in your life a better economy and the institutions have been kind of more fair. So when you went to college, it wasn't as expensive and you didn't have to take as much debt and you could buy a house cheaper and you made more money. And it's like, well, now, you know, so you look at a bank or you look at a corporation and you're not like, well, that guy's trying to rip me off. But if you're younger, you know, you have more experiences with things going wrong. Maybe your first thing you noticed about the economy was the financial crisis, right? It's very different if you're like in the 1970s, you grow up and you're like, oh, the government's screwing everything up with these regulations. And then all of a sudden there's a kind of a boom time in the 90s. You know, you're not necessarily going to distrust big business just naturally because it seemed to kind of work, right? All you got all these cool things, computers, and you know, that stuff seemed to be getting better. But if your first real experience of the economy is the financial crisis, you're not going to trust banks, right? And this is true on the right and the left. And like, it's been surprising to me because I come out of the left and I've become friends with a lot of conservatives in the last like 5 or 10 years. And I met a bunch of them because they were interested in my work on monopoly. And we just were talking and they were like, oh yeah, we were all, you know, in college when the financial crisis happened, and we think libertarianism is ridiculous, right? You can't look at the financial crisis and be like, well, libertarianism, that kind of makes sense. You can look at it and be like, well, that was bad, but like, I remember all this other stuff that happened before that was good. So, you know, let's not like, overreact to that. And then, so you do have a generational split.
So I want to pivot back to the world of finance before we finish. But before we get there, you said something at the beginning of our conversation that I found fascinating. You were joking about it. You know, when we talked about you being a Democrat, but able to work across party lines to try and, you know, achieve common objectives. And that it's very sad that that stands out these days as a kind of an outlier. And you've taken a lot of heat for this posture from the left. Now, I was in Montana last week speaking at an event, and I had spent a lot of time talking to a guy who's been integral to the political process for a long, long time. I won't name check him. But we had a very similar sort of conversation. He's someone who, he's the opposite. He's a Republican, but he has a lot of good friendships in the Democrat Party and has spent his career working across those lines to try and achieve common goals. Just talk a little bit about your philosophy on that regard and the challenges you faced in the world of today, trying to be that Democrat who will reach out across the aisle and try to get things done.
So there's a lot of cooperation kind of across the aisle, usually for bad things, right? Like lobbying.
Right.
I
know what you mean.
A ton of Republicans and a ton of Democrats. Like, you know, I guess somebody put it, they're like, yeah, the biggest party in DC is the Green Party. Am I right? Hey-o. The difference is there's a couple of things that, first of all, I work with populists on the right. It's very easy to work with, like, if you're a Democrat or banking lobbyist and you work with a Republican banking lobbyist, no one's going to be like, how dare you? Like, that's right. The big, right? I just work with Republican populists who are skeptical of corporate power. And since nobody pays me to do that, I'm not like working for a big corporation and neither are they. Part of the culture war is designed to get people who do agree on very basic questions of economic power to not talk to each other.
Right.
Like right now, there's a big strike in Hollywood against the big studios, right? One of the big studios is Disney. And like you got Ron DeSantis fighting with Disney. They should be like cooperating, but they're not. They probably hate each other. Well, that's stupid because they're both fighting with Disney and they don't totally agree on ultimate social outcomes, but both of them basically agree that Disney has too much power and they can start there. And that's like true across the board. There's a lot of fights over corporate power right now. I think what's happened is like traditionally corporate power and economic power has not been the center of politics for the last 40 years. It actually was the center of American politics, I think from like the 1770s until the 1970s. Frederick Douglass used to talk about the land monopoly as fostering slavery, right? You can find arguments about monopoly. It really was one of the two key dominant traditions in America was anti-monopoly, which you go back to Oliver Cromwell and go there if you want. That was like a core foundational element of how self-governance worked. And then starting in the 60s and 70s, a series of kind of counterculture people on the right and the left made a case that that old anti-monopoly tradition was not important and was sort of like a paranoid delusion. And so in the 80s, we kind of got airbrushed, which is like to get back to Obama, not even knowing what our banking traditions were. Like that was like injecting amnesia into our culture. And so today, what is politics? Politics is a question of how we build a society among people who don't agree with each other. That's what the art of politics is. It's a noble art, but like, what is the foundational element is trade, how we trade with one another. It's not the only thing, but is a really important part of it. And we need to talk about that as a foundational element of politics. And I think people feel very uncomfortable with that. They think of it as, well, that's for the technocrats. That's for the economists. That's for the experts. They don't want to talk about it. They think it's maybe for nerds or whatever it is. The culture war is a really easy way not to talk about that.
Yeah.
Not to think about it. And so when I come in, I'm like, no, this is like, let's talk about this, right? Like I'm unusual, not in that I reach across the aisle. I'm unusual in that I'm relatively honest about my own side,
yeah.
Right? I'm just like, Obama sucked, right? He was a bad president. He consolidated power. You will find a lot of Democrats who will be like, Obama was not as good as he could have been. Tell that to the 40 million people that were foreclosed on. Like they had a real experience. You can't deny that. I'm still Democrat. I have reasons for that. I believe like the Democrats are a better choice than the Republicans. But like, let's be honest, we did a bad job, right?
Right.
We did a bad job. So I think that that's kind of like being honest about what we did as a political party and what the other guys do as a political party. It's like if you start from that basis, then I think it's a lot easier to work together or fight with each other. But like, that's the premise of it. And I think the other part of it is that what is politics? That's like a big part of it. What do you think politics is? And for a lot of people, and I think this is like a counterculture thing on the right and left, their idea is politics is a fight over the human soul, the perfection of man, of mankind in this direction or that direction, and people arguing about the morality that should live in our heart, right? And then they fight over that. And I believe that's not what politics is. I believe politics is a fight over political institutions. How do we organize our institutions? How do we organize our laws? There's always going to be assholes in society. They're going to be racist. They're going to be people that say mean things. They're going to be bullies. They're going to be like abusive people. They're going to be saints, right? And sometimes somebody can be all of them, right? The point isn't how do you perfect mankind? The point is how do you build political institutions to bring out the best in what we are? Because man doesn't change. We just are people. We're animals, for good or bad. That's the way I think of politics. And if you think of politics as perfecting institutions, institutions that are created by us can be recreated and restructured, then you can like work with other people. I think to your question about big tech, part of the way that the culture war like occupies people, and I'm not saying culture is not important because it is. A lot of the arguments do matter. I'm not downplaying those. I'm just saying that's not the totality of politics. And when people talk about like big tech, right? Mark Zuckerberg, he's so powerful. These billionaires, they have so much money. Like Obama was the devil, or was this hope and change? Like Lord, like Trump is the monster. Like they're just people. They're all just people. They're like us. And I find that like so much of the reason people have trouble engaging in politics in a noble way is because there is this impression that we live in a world of gods and monsters, right? Or these metaphysical institutions called the market just naturally just do things, or these things called technology just do things. They act upon us and we really have no power. And I think really getting over that and recognizing that like people are just people, and everything put here by people was put here by somebody like us. And we can change it if we want to. Also, we can do bad things. Like I've accidentally done bad things in my life. I've hurt people. And like, you can't make up for that, but you can try to learn from it, admit it, and try to learn from it and not do it again. That's just kind of like my politics. And I think that's what normal people think of politics, but there is this like sort of desire for not to take that responsibility. And that's where the like deference to experts, deference to the powerful come from, because it's like, well, maybe I don't know enough. The stakes are high, right? And if you fuck up, people die. But it's like, if you don't try, then other people are going to run things. They're going to screw up too. But it's like, that's the stakes of a democracy. It's like, you're going to make mistakes and those mistakes are going to be horrible. But if you don't like try, then you're not living in a free society and you're not creating what's wonderful, which is like a free society where people can try to do what's best for them and their families and their communities.
There's so much to applaud in what you just said there. I think it was a fantastic description. You know, there's what politics is and there's what politics has become. And I think they're two very, very different things, unfortunately, in the world we live in right now. Bringing back to finance as we kind of finish our time here, you know, when you found yourself first in the political protest, it was at a time of enormous, albeit forced, collaboration between everybody. You know, there was a unified purpose to solving the global financial crisis. And so, you know, when you came into that situation, there was an awful lot of cooperation, maybe through gritted teeth. I wasn't in the rooms, but everyone was trying to work together to get bills through in a really quick speed and get things done as fast as they could. How has that changed from the inside? How much more difficult has it become since then to get things done? And what can we do about changing that back to the way it was? Do we need another crisis?
It's a good question. So I would say that there's been like a decline in political trust. You could go back to like the 70s, but you know, after 9/11, I think you saw this immense unity in the US. It was, you know, George Bush's approval rating went to 90%, and it was global. You know, there were a few areas in the world that were like, screw you, America. But most people were like, this is a giant tragedy. This is awful. And I think what Bush did, he mishandled that moment in a pretty profound way and frittered away all of that goodwill. Because that was a moment when he could have done anything. And instead of doing something grand, he said, let's go shopping. Right. And then invaded Iraq. And it was like the rest of the world, what was their lesson? Like much of America, like American institutions are pretty fucked up and stupid. Right. And that was such a giant tragedy. A giant tragedy. We'll never recover from that. And the Democrats were a big part of that. Like they voted for them. And not like just Bush, but like that was a giant tragedy. And then I think when the financial crisis happened, there was a fair amount of cooperation because people were trying to figure out what to do. People still believed in free markets, right? And they were like, well, there are these things called free markets and we need to protect them. And so there was still some trust and there was a lot of fear, but there was still basic trust in American institutions, not as much as after 9/11, but there was. And I think that Obama frittered that away by essentially creating a sort of legal category of people who are powerful enough that they don't have to obey the law and they can get credit from the government whenever they want too big to fail banks and a whole series of sort of elites. And then everybody else who is subjected to the law, right? In a kind of a brutal way. And that consolidation of power just kind of like continued to happen. And I think it was also, it's also a global story. And you see like a pretty profound decline of trust. And so trust undergirds, I think, the ability to work together and make policy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's been pretty bad. But at the same time, like, I also think that, you know, there's a reason why if faced with these crises, we really mishandled them. I think that the ideas in people's heads were really bad. So I'm not a pessimist. I'm an optimist, because what I saw after 9/11 and what I saw after the financial crisis was awful. It was taking that trust and using it for really malevolent ends. Maybe they didn't mean it that way, but they ended up hurting a lot of people, killing a lot of people, hurting a lot of people. And what I see now is a lot of learning from that and saying we need to do things differently. The trust is gone, which we have to rebuild that. And that's a long-term project. But I do think that there are a lot more antitrust suits. There's 5 antitrust suits at a federal and state level against Google. There's a lot of, like, CMA is acting. There's a lot of people trying to do things. It's kind of getting caught in this morass of judges and stuff, but it is having impacts. I think a lot of on the right and the left, you're seeing different attempts and approaches. So the rethinking, I think, is super healthy and a good thing. And that is the predicate to rebuilding trust. You also see like China, which we haven't even gotten into, which is like putting a lot of global pressure on a lot of the institutional arrangements that we used to take for granted. So I'm an optimistic, and I think that this moment of learning about political economy and the real power that we have to deal with in democratic societies, I think we haven't faced that for a long time, and I think we are starting to face it. That's a really good thing.
Well, hopefully we can save China conversation for another day, because I think you're right. I think that's an entire conversation on its own. But let's just bring it back before we close to finance. And obviously the recent banking crisis, what we saw in the wake of Silicon Valley Bank's collapse was an immediate flight to the big money center banks. You know, we saw $30 billion go into JP Morgan, Wells, Citigroup, et cetera. How would you grade the Fed's response to the crisis? And what do you think what we saw in the moment portends for the future of banking?
So the deposits went to, I don't know, 4 or 5 government banks. We call them private, but they're government banks.
Yeah,
it's just
the
CEO doesn't get paid at a G13 wage scale. It gets paid a lot more, right? people want to give their money to the government for safekeeping. And JP Morgan is a government bank, right? I think the Fed's behavior this whole time has been appalling. I am really not a Fed fan. I mean, we need a Fed. We need a central bank. But I'd say a friend of mine put it best. He will remain unnamed. But the Fed is divided into economists who run the Federal Open Market Committee, the interest rates and broad financial conditions, balance sheet management, and then the supervisor and regulatory people who are supposed to look at those specific banks, right? So if you think about what is a central bank supposed to do, the Monetary Policy Committee is like the general that says, we're going to march in this direction.
Right.
And then the supervisor and regulators take care of the troops, who are the banks that actually implement the credit conditions, that do the loans or pull the loans in based on the credit conditions, manage the capital markets. If you want to march this way, you need to make sure that when your troops start marching that way, that the wheels of the tanks don't fall off, right?
Right.
You need to make sure that the shit works. We can argue they should have raised rates or not, like they should have marched that way or this way. But the basic problem that the Fed had is when they said, we're going to tighten conditions, the wheels of the tanks fell off because they didn't pay any attention to the actual banks and what effect higher interest rates would have on the balance sheets of these banks, because they don't care about regulatory policy. They just don't care. They don't think it matters. And it's like, imagine a general not caring about whether their troops can march or not. And that is the Federal Reserve. It's a complete disgrace. So, I don't know. I mean, there's lots of ways to talk about it, but like, I don't think they should have bailed out Silicon Valley Bank. I don't think the uninsured depositors should have been bailed out. Same thing with Signature Bank. I don't know why they allowed JP Morgan to buy First Republic. I think that was crazy. I would say the people at the Fed and like the Fed adjacent people like Janet Yellen have learned nothing from the crisis except bail them out quickly. But I do think the mystique of the Fed is gone. And that is a very good thing, because the mystique of the Fed was immensely powerful. When I was working in 2009 and 10, we managed to get an audit of the Federal Reserve's Emergency Lending Authority through Congress. It was like the only non-lobbyist-backed bipartisan legislation that actually got through in Dodd-Frank. Not the only one, but one of the few ones. And the Fed is really, they're like motherfuckers in terms of their lobbying and political power in Congress. And so hopefully like that, I think their mystique is much, much, like it's radically reduced. And that's good. They should not be an independent central bank. They should be like Congress or the president should be setting monetary policy and regulatory policy, and the Fed should just be executing. Right now, we have this weird fourth branch of government that just do anything they want, and like that needs to end.
Well, that is a whole other podcast right there. We're going to have to do this again because
I know.
Well, no, look, I think it's a really important conversation to have. I'm curious, and I don't want to keep you any longer, but just when you say the Fed's mystique is gone, and that's a good thing, I completely agree. But now, do you mean, you know, because we've seen the Fed's mystique amongst the public, you can kind of see that cracking for a while now, because obviously they're starting to feel it in their pocket and suddenly what these people are saying matters. But has it also started to evaporate in policy circles? Because the impression from outside, certainly in 08, 09, was that the Fed and Paulson Bernanke managed to scare the living bejesus out of representatives and staffers because they knew so much more and there was this mystique. So has it gone in both places or just one?
No, I think it's gone in policy circles too. So there's two reasons why policymakers liked the Fed to do things. The first is they believe the Oracle, right? Like the Oracle knows what to do and don't disobey the Oracle because bad things will happen, right? It's similar to judges. It's similar to like economists. Yeah. In
general, right? And the Wizard of Oz.
Exactly, right? There's an argument that the Wizard of Oz was a parable about monetary policy.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know that. And then I think that is gone. I think there is a willingness to say, yeah, that they don't know what they're doing, right? In policy circles as well. And I see this like Peter Conte Brown, who's a very centrist scholar of the Fed, you know, very much protecting the Fed independence. Like he was horrified at what the Fed did. And he's like, this doesn't make any sense. And so the centrist policy thinkers are like unhappy with the Fed, which is something I hadn't seen before. It's usually like weirdos like me.
You and me, yeah, right.
And I've had friends of mine who've been like, I don't know that Congress should be setting monetary policy. That seems a little out there to me. And now they're like, oh yeah, I'm over it. You couldn't do a worse job. But the second problem that we haven't overcome, if the Fed isn't going to run things, and like people basically in the 2010s, Congress basically said, okay, economy, Fed, you take care of it. We don't want anything to do with it, right? That hasn't been fixed. Because if you want someone else to run things other than the Fed, you need someone else to step up and do it. And that means Congress has to step up and start to do things and run things. And it's like members of Congress have not yet decided that they have a hunger to govern, a hunger right. for power. And they need that hunger for power. I said before, the government is big but weak, right? You could say the same thing about Congress. Congress needs to be a lot stronger. It needs a lot more power, right? They need to do fewer stupid things, maybe fewer things, but they need to project power again. And until Congress projects power, we're just going to kind of flounder around and like decay, maybe collapse. But that's like the core of it is it's like people have been convinced the Fed shouldn't have power. They have not been convinced that Congress itself has not been convinced that Congress should take power. That's where we're at right now. And it's kind of similar to the antitrust thing where it's like, we've decided we don't like monopolies having power. We haven't decided that we want government to break them up. Right? We'll get there, you know, hopefully before we collapse.
Well, listen, Matt, I'm going to ask you to promise me on air that you'll come back and we'll have this conversation about power, because I think it's such an important conversation to have. But it's a podcast all in its own. So hopefully you'll promise me on air that you'll come back and we can have that conversation.
Absolutely not. This was outrageous. I'll never come back. Everything you said was rude. I'm offended. Yeah, of course. I'd love to.
Excellent. So the standard reply then. Hey, listen, before you go, listen, give Goliath and Big a good plug. I will do likewise in the outro, but it never hurts to do it twice.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. So my book is called Goliath, the 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. And it's about this dormant tradition of monopoly power in the 20th century in the U.S., and it's fun. I wrote it to be fun. So it's like stories that you'll get into. And then I write a newsletter called Big, which is on the politics of monopoly power and finance. And I go into all sorts of weird, like I wrote up a whole series on like monopoly in the cheerleading industry, but I also do a lot on tech. I've done some stuff on like why Hollywood is misaligned and like all these different areas. So I really enjoy writing that, but I think people like reading it. So subscribe.
So look, the big is on Substack. You can find Matt on Substack for that. And the book you'll find in Amazon. And I believe the phrase is all good booksellers. Isn't that what they used to say whenever a book was released? Matt, thank you for your time. Thank you for your candor. And thank you for the work you do. I think it's really important. And I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this. Have a good one.
Well, there you have it, folks. I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. And we've teased a couple of really big conversations to have there. One about China, we'll have it different day. But I'm very, very interested to have this conversation about power, where it should lie, who should be responsible for it. Because I think that's a place that Matt and I will agree and disagree in all kinds of places. So I'll make sure that Matt's as good as his word and comes back and we have that conversation. As he said, his book, Goliath, is a tremendous read. It's full of stories. I think it's something you'll really, really enjoy. So do pick that up. You'll find that at Amazon. And Matt's Substack is Matt Stoller, 2Ts2Ls.substack.com. And Big is, again, a really good read and something I would encourage you to subscribe to. You'll also find him on Twitter, at Matthew Stoller. And again, Matt's just, he's a really good man and a great thinker and a really gifted communicator. So I can't urge you strongly enough to follow what he says, whether you're on the left or the right. I think, as you've heard today, Matt is someone that both sides can talk to and have a reasoned debate with, which is rare in this day and age. That's it for me from another episode. I'll be back again with another podcast in the very, very near future. I've got several lined up this week, so stand by for those. In the meantime, thanks as always for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.